From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The New Hampshire retail and hospitality industries are thrilled with a new rule from the Canadian government. As of June 1st, day trippers from our northern neighbor can bring home $200 worth of goods duty-free, way more than the previous $50 limit. For Canadians who stay longer, the limit's even higher, and so that incentive, plus the fact that many products are more expensive in Canada to begin with, means the Granite State is hoping for a nice bump in business this summer. But north of the border, the reaction is quite different. Many Canadians are upset with this change. They worry it'll be a huge drain on their country's consumer spending, and it comes after years of a net tourism outflow from Canada, with 2.7 Canadian visits to the U.S. for every one visit in the other direction. Of course, overall, the U.S. and Canada are huge allies and trading partners, but tensions do come up when you have two nations' economies so closely intertwined, and relations can feel more touchy when those economies are sluggish. For example, Canada didn't see anything close to the recession we experienced, and now as this country hopes to rebound, it's only too happy to get some help from Canadian visitors heading south. Today in The Exchange, the two-way street of U.S.-Canada economic ties. We'll look at how important this relationship is, what's involved in it, and some of the issues that have come up over the years. And let's hear from you too this hour. Are you Canadian, or travel there often, or have regular business with Canada? How would you describe this economic relationship? Is it a fair one, and what might improve it? The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org, or post your comments on our Facebook page. We have two guests. Joining us from Stowe, Vermont is Tom Velk, economics professor with McGill University in Montreal. He directs the North American Studies program there, focusing on monetary economics and public policy. And Tom Velk, really nice to have you. Thanks for giving us your time this morning.
Glad to be here.
Also joining us from New York City, Ted Alden, senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. His research includes U.S. economic competitiveness and trade policy. He's the author of The Closing of the American Border. Ted has also worked as a reporter in Canada, and although he's American, he grew up there. And Ted, nice to meet you too on the phone, and thanks for giving us your time this hour.
Good to be here, Laura. Thanks very much.
Well, and Ted, I'll start with you. You know, given all the attention on Europe's economic troubles all over the news, China's economic dominance is a big story. How much do you think Americans are aware of this huge and vital economic relationship we have with Canada?
Well, I think, you know, it's been a long-standing complaint in Canada that the United States never pays enough attention. You know, Canada sees itself as the sort of Rodney Dangerfield of countries, that it just don't get no respect from the United States. And I think that's been the case as long as I've been paying attention to the U.S.-Canada relationship. So, you know, I mean, the reasons are obvious. For Canada, the U.S. market is so important, even though exports to the United States as a percentage of Canadian exports have fallen a bit in the last decade. Still about three-quarters of all Canadian exports go to the United States. For the U.S., Canada remains the largest export market, about a fifth of U.S. exports go to Canada, but the impact comparatively is much smaller. So, and because the relationship, you know, as you mentioned at the outset, works so well most of the time, it rarely gets a lot of attention on this side of the border. A lot more focus on the difficulties doing business in China, or the turmoil in Europe, or what's going on south of the border with the violence in Mexico. Canada just doesn't make the headlines all that often, which is probably a good thing.
There's no crisis there.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, crises make good news, and there aren't many in the U.S.-Canada relationship.
Well, and I knew that Canada was a very important export market for the U.S., but boy, three-quarters, Ted, of all Canadian exports go to the U.S. That's huge.
Well, it's huge, but a lot smaller than it used to be. So, you know, it is the key relationship for Canada, but you know, as Tom knows well, Canada's been doing a lot to try to diversify its trading arrangements and had some real success in that over the last decade or two. The Chinese market's a lot more important to Canada.
Well, and
than
that's
it used
interesting,
to be.
Yeah. And Tom Velk, let me bring you into this. You know, how would you
right.
say this relationship has changed? I'm intrigued by what Ted is talking about.
Well, I mean, the importance can't be overstated. 25% of America's energy requirements come down from Canada, whether it's electricity, gas, oil, $2 to $3 billion in trade a day move between the two countries. The Ambassador Bridge connecting Windsor and Detroit carries sometimes $1 billion a day just by itself, and it's been the source of a great gain and wealth for both countries, and also a great challenge. The most courageous thing that former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney did during his tenure in office was to innovate the NAFTA arrangement with Mr. Reagan and Mr. Bush, and it made an enormous improvement in Canada's economic stability and welfare. But the challenges go forward. I have a student right now, for example, who's associated with Rio Tinto, who's going to go out to Kitimat, British Columbia, where they may very well be the outlet for oil to China. And the interesting thing about that that proposition up there is that the big engineering is going to be done by Rio Tinto and Bechtel, the great American engineering firm. So these challenges, these changes, these dramatic developments in international trade that involve Canada and the U.S. deeply involve both countries in this integrated way. Bechtel, of course, being one of the great Canadian and American engineering firms, it will mean jobs, money, profits, investment questions, and trade questions for both countries. It is the challenge is to keep government focused on, as an economist speaking at least, on the enormous benefits from trade, and to pay less attention to various kinds of special interests all over the map, ranging from large firms to large unions to various interest groups ideologically motivated who are interested in diminishing these gains from trade. I think that's the great challenge, is to keep before the public the importance of trade for the consumer, for the real citizen, the unorganized citizen, who isn't always represented in these debates.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you about NAFTA in a couple minutes. But before we go any further, Tom, just remind us, you know, we focused a ton on our own program here in The Exchange, a lot on the New Hampshire economy, the national economy.
Right.
How are Canadians viewing their own economic health lately, Tom? My impression is they didn't do as poorly as we did during this recession, but I might be wrong.
Oh, no, Canada is, if you looked at the G7, Canada has emerged from the recession in the best shape. And interestingly, they have been the least aggressive in terms of their policies. They expanded their money stock much less than than the U.S. did. They increased their debts much less. Their total debt load is much smaller. So that in a sense, not only did they survive the recession much better than the U.S. did, but since they wrenched their policies around to a much less extent, there was a lot less debate about what was done. In an interesting way to look at it is that Canada did a lot less than almost anybody else in the G7, succeeded better, and in that sense caused itself the least amount of domestic turmoil over the strategies of policy.
Yes.
The guy who's running things now, Mr. Stephen Harper, just recently got himself reelected with a majority government. And I think he's safe as houses for the next 3 or 4 years, and he is moving forward with his agenda, not without, of course, opposition. The opposition has 800-some amendments to his budget bill that they're fighting their way through in the next day or so. But realistically, on the ground, there is no significant challenge to the leadership of the country, in contrast to the U.S. situation.
Sure. And, Ted, I want your thoughts on the Canadian economy, too, what sort of shape it's in. But let me also invite our listeners to join us at 1-800-892-6477. If you are Canadian yourself, or you travel there often, or you have lots of business with Canada, join us. How would you describe this economic relationship that we're hearing about? Do you think it's a fair and equitable one? Is there anything something you would do to improve it. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org or go to our Facebook page. And Ted, I know in addition to your professional interests, you travel back and forth between Canada and the U.S. all the time. What's your impression of how Canadians are feeling about their economy these days?
Well, you know, it's interesting to compare the current situation to the last big recession that both countries experienced in 1990-91. That was a rather mild recession in the United States. It was deep enough to cost the first George Bush his re-election. But it wasn't actually a very deep recession in the United States. In Canada, in contrast, the recession of the early 90s hit the country very hard and was really one of the things that triggered a big restructuring in the Canadian economy, which you saw in the 1990s. You saw government finally get its budget situation in order in the 1990s with a bunch of tough decisions. You saw a number of kind of pro-business innovations in the Canadian government to try to attract investment to the country. So 90s was very hard for Canada, but it came out quite strongly. In contrast, as we all know, the 90s were boom times here in the United States, but really leading to a bubble situation in the housing market, which has collapsed with really devastating consequences. So this recession, the Great Recession, has hit the United States very hard. Canada has comparatively been rather immune and really skated through the recession with minimal economic damage, despite Canada's trade dependence on the United States, which is really rather remarkable. Normally, you would think that as the U.S. goes down, Canada would be dragged along with it, but partly because of high prices for Canadian natural resources, Canadian economy has really fared much better in this recession than the U.S. economy has.
So Canadians
are generally feeling a lot better than Americans at the moment.
Yeah, so even though that huge trading partner, the United States, was probably not buying as much stuff from Canada, Ted, you're saying Canada emerged okay.
I mean, selling, you know, a lot of oil raw materials. You know, oil prices have gone up high. Canada's, you know, the largest oil exporter of the United States. So there are just a number of things that have made the Canadian economy very resilient over the last 5 years, much more so than the United States or Europe, as you mentioned at the outset.
All right. And coming up after a break, we'll pick up on some of those subjects that both of you gentlemen mentioned, including the North American Free Trade Agreement and the energy issue. I also want to talk to you both about tourism a little bit more, because that's where many here in New Hampshire are looking forward to a good summer. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions or comments. 1-800-892-6477.
You're listening to The Exchange here on NHPR. Coming up at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Top journalists bring you the inside story behind the week's most important national news and what it means for you. Join us for the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 here on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, from Grupponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Grupponi Auto Junction in Bow, and online 24 hours a day at grupponi.com. And from New Hampshire Fish and Game, conserving wildlife and natural places, enhancing our quality of life and connecting you to life outdoors, on the web at wildnh.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the U.S.-Canada two-way economic relationship. As we've been saying, with all the focus on Europe's economic woes, China's clout, it's easy to overlook that our nation's largest geographic border is also our largest trading partner. We've been looking at this relationship, how important it is, and some of the tensions that have come up over the years. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. If you're from Canada or spend significant time there for business or pleasure, what's your impression of this economic relationship, and what might happen, in your opinion, to improve it? Our number again, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can also post your comments on our Facebook page. Our guests are Ted Alden, Senior Fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. He has also worked as a reporter in Canada. He's American, but he grew up there. And joining us from Stowe, Vermont, Tom Velk, Economics Professor at McGill University in Montreal. And gentlemen, let's go to our callers now. And Phil is joining us from, of all places, Mitchell, South Dakota. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi, yeah, Mitchell, South Dakota, home of the world's only corn palace.
Congratulations, yeah. Phil.
I'm originally from New England, so I try to listen to your program from time to time.
Well, go ahead, Phil. Thanks for joining
us. Let's see. The big news out here is the Keystone XL pipeline. And, you know, there are people that are for it, people that are against it. If the Keystone XL pipeline goes through the central part of the United States, what impact will it have regionally here in the Midwest and also the rest of the United States?
Well, Phil, it's a great question. And again, good to know people in South Dakota are listening to The Exchange. You know, Tom, I'm going to throw that to you first, but Ted, I want to hear from you as well. What do you think, Tom? Canada has huge energy resources. I think you mentioned earlier that 25% of U.S. energy comes from Canada.
Goodbye. Right. I'm still here. That was my computer talking.
Goodbye.
Yeah, that is still talking. I should just step away from the keyboard, I guess. Well, I think it's a terribly important relationship. The Keystone operation is, vital to American interest, but it can be exaggerated. You know, an awful lot of that pipeline already exists, an awful lot of the oil already flows. The pipeline is really a straightening of what currently is kind of a zigzag pipeline that doesn't quite get to its goal down in Texas. But what is really going on is the Obama administration's fiddling with the deal has gotten the West in Canada more than a little annoyed, and also the Harper government annoyed enough, so that they are very realistically talking about shipping that oil to the West Coast. That was a proposition that I mentioned off the top. One of my students is, as a matter of fact, involved in the Kitimat, the British Columbia endpoint of what could be a new pipeline that would allow the oil to be delivered to Asian buyers.
Interesting.
And Mr. Harper has basically said, listen, USA, you want to play around with something that's essential to our interest, the Canadian interest, selling that oil. We're going to, you know, put it right in your ear and give it to your good friend, Mr. China. I think that has won Mr. Harper a lot of support in Canada, because sometimes he's seen as sort of too close to the Americans or too friendly and too conservative and so on. But in an odd way, the situation with Keystone has given him a chance to if not exactly put his thumb in the American eye, at least threatened to, he's wiggling his thumb kind of close to the American face with that threat to sell the oil across the sea.
Interesting. So playing a China card there, Tom.
Oh, he certainly is, and it's very realistic. It's not completely anti-American. Again, as I said off the top, Bechtel, the great engineering firm, is going to be one of the players should that oil end up being delivered to the Canadian West Coast, a lot of the engineering will be done by Bechtel and Rio Tinto and other sort of international firms that have, deep American roots.
You know, I want to ask you, Ted Alden, too, about energy issues that Phil raises. And Phil, thanks a lot for calling in. But more broadly, we've got the Keystone Pipeline, and then closer to home, we've got this proposed Northern Pass Hydro-Québec proposal that's created a lot of controversy here in New Hampshire. By the way, I want to let our listeners know we'll be looking at that more closely on Monday. But a couple questions for you, too, Ted. First of all, what's your take on why these projects have generated so much heat on our side of the border? It's not like Canada is, you know, Iran or anything.
No, I mean, I think, you know, I agree with Tom that I think Keystone, in terms of the oil that will be moved, actually doesn't matter all that much. It's an improvement of an existing line. It'll make it easier to send more oil from the Canadian oil sands down to the Gulf refineries, which will probably help keep gas prices somewhat lower in the United States. The reason it's become a symbolic battle. I mean, you have the Obama administration has a lot of environmentalists that support the administration and are quite worried about Canadian oil sands development. I mean, this is dirty oil that contributes a great deal to global warming issues, and so that, you know, there are constituencies that are important to the administration that are quite reluctant to encourage expansion of oil sands production in Canada. The second issue is, you know, questions about the safety of the pipeline. I think there's every reason to believe that the oil can be transported safely, but remember, we're not that long after the deep water disaster in the Gulf, and there were all of the assurances by the companies prior to that that, of course, we know what we're doing. We can drill safely at these extremely deep depths, and then, you know, you had the spill there, which dumped an awful lot of oil into the Gulf. So I think, you know, the administration has been under pressure from some groups that are rather important to it. So Keystone has really become a symbolic battle. I mean, just quickly, obviously, and on the Republican side, you know, it's being used against the president as an example, you know, of you know, him not wanting to pursue domestic North American continental energy development as aggressively as the Republicans would like to see. So really, for both sides, it's been a big symbolic battle.
And Phil asked, and it's a good question, Ted, about the economic implications. I mean, if this doesn't go through here in the U.S., as you said, there's a lot of controversy, and we could talk about this for hours. But economically, does it hurt Canada? It sounds like from what Tom says, you know, Canada will just go, okay, we'll just bring it to the coast and ship it to China.
Yeah.
What's
oil, you know, oil is a global product. You can sell it anywhere. So as long as the Canadians can transport it, and they do have alternatives on their West Coast, they will be able to sell it. I mean, Phil's question about impact in the Midwest, I think it will be small. I mean, there will be construction-related work associated with the building of the pipeline, but then that oil is just going to flow right through the Midwest down to the Gulf refinery. So I think the broader impact would be in terms of supply to those refineries, and if you've got a steady supply, that generally helps to keep the price of refined petroleum products, including gasoline, somewhat lower than they would be otherwise. So you'll have a kind of impact across the United States. But I think the impact specifically in the Midwest is going to be fairly short term.
All right. Well, again, Phil, thanks for joining us. And here's an email, gentlemen, that I want to share with you. Jim from Dublin has sent us an email. He says, please comment on the Canadian banking system in terms of not following the U.S. and removing Glass-Steagall-type regulations, and how this and other economic conditions contributed to the dramatic change in the U.S. dollar and Canadian dollar over the last 5 years. And this is an issue we really should talk about, gentlemen, because, you know, 7, 8, 9 years ago, I think, Tom, the U.S. dollar was pretty strong against the Canadian loonie. Now it's almost parity. Maybe the Canadian dollar is even a little stronger.
Yes, it has been over par and under par recently. Well, the banking thing is very interesting. You know, America, going all the way back to the time of Andrew Jackson, has had a very odd attitude about banking. We've tried to keep it small, and we've had, I remember when I first started studying money and banking, well, probably before you were born, Laura, there were 14,000 banks in the United States. Now, there's still damn near 10,000. In Canada, there's six, or really five, that amount to anything. Nonetheless, they have been much healthier in the sense of much lower failure rate. And oddly enough, I think their political power of the Canadian banks has made it difficult for government to do some of the silly things that government has done with banking in the U.S. I mean, to my way of thinking, one of the biggest things that caused our recent troubles was legislation that forced American banks to lend money to ninjas, no job, no income, no assets, people who weren't going to pay their debts, but who are going to vote.
Ninjas. And, I never heard that before.
Oh, no, no job, no income, no assets. You know, well, those were the folks who were getting those loans that were, in my point of view, it was politically useful to the legislators who forced that kind of, the Community Reinvestment Act is where it starts, back in LBJ's time. The Canadian banks never did that, and I think, as oddly enough, is because they had the political power to tell their legislators, who would also certainly be willing to buy votes. I mean, Canadian legislators are just as interested in buying votes from ninjas as American are. But the Canadian banks forced, I think, a situation in which they were much more prudent and moderate in their lending policies and in their total strategies. And as a consequence, among other dimensions of Canada's recent success in dealing with the pressures of the worldwide recession, the financial community was in much better shape to begin with and really throughout. the aid that had to come from government in the sense of monetary ease, this QE phrase that people use, essentially banks are buying up government debt.
That's a Federal Reserve policy. It's been pretty controversial,
yeah, exactly.
But yeah.
Well, it is, but I mean, they did much less than that.
So they got into less trouble, basically.
Well, but it's not so much that they got, yes, well, there was less trouble. whether the trouble initiated from bad banking policy or bad public policy is a subject of some debate, but there was less trouble in Canada, and the banking and the whole financial community has remained healthier than it has been in other parts of the world, especially the U.S., right throughout the past 5-year period.
Well, and Jim, thanks for the question. And to the other part of his question now, a little bit more, Ted, if you could, what is happening right now with that dollar-to-dollar exchange rate? For a long time, it was favorable in our direction.
Can I just weigh in, if you don't mind, quickly on the banks? Because
sure.
Literally the day after I started as the bureau chief in Toronto for the Financial Times back in 1998, I think it was, if I'm remembering properly, the very next morning I woke up to a headline in the Globe and Mail and the Financial Post, which were the two papers, the big papers at the time, that the Canadian banks wanted to merge. I mean, Tom has gone on about the wisdom of the banks in the Canadian context. Well, the first story that I covered in Toronto was how those 5-6 big banks wanted to, in effect, become 2 or 3 really big banks. And this was when, you know, merger frenzy was sweeping the United States. Canadian banks wanted to get on board. And in this case, actually, you had a Canadian government that had the wisdom to say no, to say, you know, we have already a pretty consolidated banking system. If those mergers go ahead, we're going to have an extremely consolidated banking system, and that will be less stable than the one we have. So, you know, I think, you know, you can have the interpretation that the Canadian banks were politically powerful enough to prevent the government from doing stupid things. But similarly in Canada, you had a government that was powerful enough to prevent the banks from doing stupid things. And that was one of the things that was lacking in this country in the run-up to the financial crisis. But quickly, just on currency, you know, again, when I started with the FT in Toronto, the value of the Canadian dollar was down in the 60s. I remember having a conversation with my father because my father was a professor at the University of British Columbia and had retired to the United States, and he was collecting his pension in Canadian dollars.
Oh, dear.
And he asked me, he said, should I cash out? Should I take a lump sum and put all of it in American dollars? And it's the single smartest piece of financial advice I ever gave. I said, Dad, I don't know how long it'll take, but Canadian fundamentals don't warrant a dollar in the mid-60s. It will go up. Hang on to your pension. So eventually I was right. The Canadian dollar went up quite strongly and has now been in parity for the last several years. Again, a lot of that having to do with the strength of Canadian resource exports.
Well, yes, Canadian resource exports meaning natural gas.
Oil and minerals and natural gas less so. It's a little hard to export, but primarily oil and minerals and to a lesser extent agricultural goods.
Well, thanks again for the email, Jim. And our number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also go to our Facebook page. If you are from Canada yourself, or if you spend a significant amount of time there for business or for pleasure, give us your questions and impressions of this very important economic relationship that we're looking at today. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And here's Luke, who commented on New Hampshire Public Radio's Facebook page. Luke says, hello, my fiance and I travel to Montreal almost every summer for the Jazz Festival. We love, capital letters, Canada. Luke asks, could you please explain why private U.S. and Canadian citizens must pay duty on goods carried across the border when we have a free trade agreement with our lovely neighbor to the north? Luke, it's a great question. What do you think, Tom?
Boy, would I love to talk about this. You know, as most economists are, I'm a very staunch supporter of free trade. It's wonderful to hear our political leaders on both sides talking about having more of it. But, you know, realistically, there are a great many impediments to trade because, again, politicians on both sides of the border of all parties pay a lot of attention to special interests. I've just recently, in the past 2 months, I spent 2 months doing it. I imported a car from the U.S. to Canada cheap car. The whole car cost maybe $5,000, $6,000. I've spent about $4,000 dealing with various enormously complicated and incredibly irritating problems with customs and registrations and taxes and inspections and so on that are de facto tariffs of a most onerous kind. When I come back the other way, I cross the border a couple of times a week. The Americans are taking, X-raying me to make sure I'm not carrying any green onions, mangoes, or tomatoes. All of it is one way or another secret protectionism, secret tariffs, de facto tariffs and protections for industries that are, that have enough political clout to get the on the American side to get the agricultural inspectors worried about tomatoes, or on the Canadian side to get. When you buy a new car in Canada, a car made in Canada, and there's several places, of course, where lots of automobiles are put together, and that car is shipped to the U.S. In the U.S., those cars can cost $5,000 to $10,000 more for a Canadian than they cost an American. It's just an extraordinary degree of de facto trade impairment that goes on, and if there is one place where I would hope, although I think hopelessly, because there's too much political reality involved, that the folks who are in favor of free trade would start working on these de facto inefficiencies, as economists sometimes like to call them, that really do get in the way of a much more open and a much more consumer-friendly border.
So despite the trade agreement on paper, sounds like you're saying there's a lot of little annoyances that both sides would do a better job cleaning
up. Oh, yes, and they're not so little when you add them all up, so that an ordinary person or ordinary small businessman here in Vermont, there's I don't know if a lot of your listeners get up to Montreal enough to know about Montreal bagels and how great Montreal bagels are. There's a guy down in Vermont who opened up a little bagel shop modeled on the world-famous in Canada, St. Viateur Bagel Works. He has an enormous amount of trouble bringing in bagel dough, bringing in smoked salmon, bringing in the right kind of smoked meat, pastrami, as we call it in the U.S., and his difficulties are all, at least my way of thinking, just their aspects of various American protectionism.
Okay, and Tom, I got to cut you off there. I apologize.
I'm rattling on.
All right. We will take a very short break, and we'll be right back.
We've been underwriting on NHPR for about 10 years. One of the things we saw immediately after underwriting was just people, clients, potential clients, business colleagues, people at conferences mentioning, hey, I heard you on the radio today. So the fact that so many people heard our spots really showed that not only were people listening, but they were paying attention to what they were hearing on New Hampshire Public Radio. My name is Jim Simoes, and I'm the president of Lewis Carno & Company Communications.
For more about underwriting, visit the business support page at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, from New England College, celebrating the 10th anniversary of the MFA in Poetry program. Poetry readings with faculty, alumni, and students begin June 22nd. Information at nec.edu. And from Holloway Motor Cars of Manchester, authorized Mercedes-Benz dealer featuring the 2012 E-Class, combining a signature blend of performance, luxury, and technology. BenzCars.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, we get the latest on the Northern Pass Project. Email us your questions, comments, concerns before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us Monday morning live at 9. Today, we're looking at economic relations between the U.S. and Canada, and we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. If you're Canadian yourself, or if you travel there often, or you have regular business with Canada, how would you describe this economic relationship? Do you see it as a fair one? What do you think it would take to make it even better than it already is? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org, or you can go to The Exchange's Facebook page. And gentlemen, speaking of making the relationship better, Tom mentioned just before the break, difficulties at the border, despite big pronouncements by the heads of both nations about the importance of commerce. They had a big announcement just today about a bridge opening up in Michigan and how important this whole relationship is. I wonder what you think, too, Ted, following up on what Tom said, that, you know, despite what we say about the importance of the free flow of goods and people, it can be kind of sticky.
I think that Tom is a braver man than I am. I've moved back and forth from Canada to the United States several times, and every time I sold my car before I went across the border.
Yeah, just didn't want to deal with it.
I just knew how difficult it was to bring a car from one country to the other. I think harder actually going north from the United States into Canada. One time I had actually bought a fairly new car, and I still decided it made more sense to sell it than to try to bring it into Canada. There are a lot of obstacles. I mean, there's sort of two issues. One is the long-standing one that Tom talks about, which is there are a lot of regulatory differences between the two countries, and the border is the place where they get enforced. You know, if it's a product that doesn't meet Canadian specifications or vice versa, you're going to have a tough time bringing it into the country. Canadians want to collect tax on goods bought in the United States since they've got a goods and services tax. So that is often an issue at the border, even where there's no duty on the item, because mostly there are not any duties left on products under the free trade agreements. So that's a long-standing issue. The more recent issue really has been the post 9/11 issue that I've written a lot about, which is that you know, the level of inspections has gone up significantly at the border, particularly for traffic coming from Canada into the United States, and the result has periodically been some pretty big delays, particularly in the summer tourist season. The two, you know, if you mentioned the Canadian dollar, you know, historically it used to be every time the Canadian dollar got strong, the shoppers would flood south. Post 9/11, that didn't happen. Even after the Canadian dollar strengthened, the traffic remained fairly stagnant down to the United States. And one of the big reasons was just that it became a lot more difficult to cross the border. You know, you now need a passport or some other proper crossing identification. The lines are likely to be long. The two governments are taking this quite seriously. I mean, President Obama and Prime Minister Harper about a year ago launched what they call the Beyond the Border Initiative, which is the most serious effort we've seen in about 8-9 years now to really try to deal with some of these border impediments. It's being handled at high levels in both governments. So I'm optimistic we will see some improvements. This summer will actually be an interesting test with the new higher duty exemptions. There's clearly going to be more southbound traffic, and it will be interesting to see whether that results in long lines coming into the United States. If it does, I think you're going to see, again, a lot of pressure to try to deal with these problems.
Well, and let's talk a little bit more about that, if we could, gentlemen. And, you know, it was fun for me yesterday to compare the headlines from both sides of the border. The headlines here in New Hampshire were, this is great, and the Retail Association is excited, and the hospitality industry is excited, and Canadians come to New Hampshire a lot to recreate, and people here are just thrilled by this decision to increase the level under which duty-free goods will be allowed back into Canada. But on the Canadian side of the border, and you gentlemen know this better than I do, Ted, you know, the big headline is, why is Harper doing this to his own consumer spending? What do you think, Ted? Why did Mr. Harper decide to allow a lot more goods back into Canada duty-free?
Well, I don't know. I'm not on the inside of this one, and Tom may have some insights. I mean, I think for Harper, I think Harper believes it was ludicrous. I mean, I think Harper is ideologically very much of a free trader. I think he has made a political decision to work very closely with the United States on border issues. This is an issue that's important to members of Congress from border states like New Hampshire and New York. And so I think he just believed this would be a good thing to do for Canada-U.S. relations. And in terms of the pressures on him, you know, the big companies in Canada all want to see these border impediments removed so that cross-border trade is easier. The interests that want to see Canadians discouraged from shopping in the United States, you know, they're the little retail shops on the Canadian side of the border, and they just don't have a whole heck of a lot of clout in Ottawa. So I'm actually, you know, what surprises me is not that this was done, but that exemption, the $50, remained as low as it was for so many years. I mean, it's been that way for a long time now, and it's an absurdly low number. Everyone would agree.
Our number again here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email, gentlemen. This brings up some of the border issues that we just mentioned. This is from Jared. He says, says he lives 100 miles south of the Canadian border in Bradford, Vermont. He says, when it comes to tourism, I have a regional mentality, regularly visit neighboring New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Maine, and New York. When it comes to Quebec, however, I'm a little put off by the fact that I would need a passport to cross the border. Jared says, I grew up in the 90s. My friends and I never had to present passports driving into Canada. Now I don't think it would be worth the expense and hassle to obtain one, simply to visit one of my closest neighbors. Jared says, I've been told it's for reasons of national security, but I don't buy it. I look at it as just one of the many ways the federal government has imposed regulations that bring in revenue under the guise of national security. He says, it's unnecessary, and I won't get a passport to visit Canada. What do you think, Tom?
Well, he doesn't need a passport to come into Canada. He needs his passport to get back into the USA. I mean, that's the irony.
So don't blame Canada. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, don't blame Canada for it. And there is a lot of absurdity that has been introduced because of this excessive and often, you know, politically correct form of so-called safety concerns and terrorism concerns and so on. It's the Canadian border parallel of the little old granny getting patted down at the airport. I agree with Ted completely that the Harper has a couple of interests. In the first place, there is an opportunity for simple harassment if the inspector discovers that you've got, you know, $53 worth of stuff that you're bringing back in instead of $50. It's an excuse or at least can be viewed as the by the consumer as a as simple bureaucratic harassment, and no politician needs to have his bureaucrats doing that sort of thing to his voters. And also, the big retailers are already in Canada. The Walmarts and so on are there. So if there is a political angle to it, they're not going to insist that Canada blocks the import of into Canada of Walmart goods from Walmart New Hampshire to Walmart Canada, and finally it's just I think it's consistent certainly with I agree with Ted with completely consistent with Harper's ideology. He's fundamentally a classical free trader, classical small D conservative guy, and he thinks that these barriers, if it may even contribute to corruption, because maybe if you know the border guard, he'll wink at you for $60 worth of stuff, and he may not do it to the next guy.
Yeah, so well, you know, Ted, you've written about this. Again, you're author of The Closing of the American Border. Real quickly to Jared's main point, he's right, isn't he? He didn't need a passport in the 90s, right? I think I've been up there.
No, you didn't need anything. I mean, the so-called Millennium Bomber, Ahmed Rassam, was trying to travel from Canada into the United States to bomb the L.A. airport. He showed the border guard a Costco card. That was his form of identification. Fortunately, the customs officer was suspicious, and he never made it into the United States. What might be helpful to your listeners, and I happen to support the identification requirements. I think if you look at some of the security risks that were there in the 90s, it was just the system was too lax. You can certainly argue it's gone too far in the other direction now, but he doesn't need a passport. He can get from the State Department what's called a passport card, which is a wallet-sized card you can use for travel into Canada, to Mexico, to the Caribbean for a vacation. $55 for a first-time applicant, $30 if you've had a passport in the past. It's pretty low cost. You do it once, it's good for 10 years. It's a hassle. I can understand people on principle saying, you know, I didn't need to used to have one of these. Why should I have to have one now? Well, the reality is you just do, and it's not all that expensive to get one. And so I would encourage Jared, is it, and all of your listeners to get themselves a passport card and go up to Montreal for the Jazz Festival. It's too good to miss.
Like Luke and his fiance. Well, Jared, thanks for the email. I appreciate what you're saying. Our number here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.com. NHPR.org. You know, gentlemen, just a couple last questions for you. And we've talked about this partnership and NAFTA and the energy policies and the fact that Canada didn't endure such a tough time during the recession, partly because of some of the policy decisions that were made. We've talked about border security and the currencies and so forth. What would you say, Tom Velk, is the number one factor that could upset what is right now a very good partnership? Is it security? Is it the currency? Is it energy? What do you think?
Well, there is an existing tension between what you might call political positions, which is the reverse of the standard one. Canada has a conservative government that's going to be going to hang on to office for the next 4 years, and they will continue, I think, to have as an ideological foundation a belief in free trade and a kind of a global attitude and a willingness to challenge the U.S. By way of, say, this China option that they have for their oil, exactly because they cannot. Mr. Harper does not wish to be seen to be some kind of American puppet. In the U.S., we'll find out in November if the radical, the progressive, the left challenge that Mr. Obama represents by way of less enthusiasm for free trade, more a willingness to. To have a government manipulate currencies and tariff levels and trade levels, it's a complete reversal of the situation back in the 90s, where the Canadians were so antagonistic to free trade and the Americans wanted it. At that time, those differences of opinion created tensions. It's possible that a kind of a reversal of those tensions in terms of the players might happen again.
So one thing to watch for...
Especially with respect to energy.
And that's a big issue, as we talked about. Even got that caller from South Dakota asking about Keystone. So one thing you'd say real quick, Tom, to watch for is... If we don't want to play ball economically with Canada, you know, these days they'll just go find somebody else to play ball with.
Oh, absolutely. No question.
What do you think, Ted, should be on the radar for those who want to keep this economic relationship as healthy as it is today?
I really do think that that security remains potentially the biggest threat. I mean, a lot of Americans to this day believe that one or more of the 9/11 hijackers entered the United States from Canada. I mean, none of them did. They all came on planes from overseas, mostly from Saudi Arabia. But, you know, as we know from the Rassam case, the Millennium Bombing, there have been attempts to use Canada as an entry point to the United States for terrorist groups. And I think were there to be a successful attack in the United States, if there was a group that had established itself in Canada, managed to make its way to the United States and carried out an attack, I think that would be a huge problem for the two countries, because all of the positive progress that's been made in the border in the last couple of years would really be threatened. If there was such a situation, it would be enormous political pressure in the United States to really, really clamp down on that border much more than we've seen so far. So I think that is still potentially the biggest thing that could disrupt the relationship. And it's one reason I think that the Harper government, the Obama administration, are actually putting a lot of attention to this issue, even though, you know, we're now more than 10 years after the 9/11 attack.
Wow, so I hear you. So even though we've been talking economics today, Ted, these security concerns are so closely intertwined with the economic relationship. You can't separate it, even though you want to say, as some of our listeners have said, look, this is a pain in the neck and it's too slow and so forth. You're saying, look, this is the reality. You got to deal with that.
You know, if you look at the reaction in the United States after 9/11, you look at what happened at that border, you know, there were lineups of 12, 14 hours at the bridges coming across into Michigan.
Really?
I didn't know that. I think you would see a semi. It took a long, long time to sort that out, and the effects lingered for a number of years. And unfortunately, I think you would see the same reaction again in the United States. So I think, you know, if you ask what sort of sequence of events or event is most likely to disrupt what right now is a pretty good economic relationship, that's it. And so I think that's why the governments are focused on it.
Tom, what do you think?
I don't disagree with that. I guess I see it as as kind of a one-time, one-event, one-focus problem. Into the long run, a greater integration of North America economically and even to some degree politically, in the sense of moving people back and forth, is the long run challenge to economic development. But I don't disagree with Ted that very bad things would happen to the relationship if Canada were to be involved with a big security failure. That would be very, very bad for Canada and the U.S. too, but especially bad for Canada.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us today. I enjoyed it. And Tom Velk, good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Grand to be here.
From Stowe, Vermont, Tom Velk, economics professor with McGill University in Montreal, where he directs the North American Studies Program, focusing on monetary economics and public policy. And Ted Alden, thank you also for the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much. I've enjoyed it.
From New York City, that's Ted Alden, senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. His research includes U.S. economic competitiveness and U.S. trade policy. He's also the author of The Closing of the American Border, which looks in part at what happened at the U.S.-Canada border after 9/11. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Craig Martin. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern today is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Become a fan of our Facebook page. You can learn more about upcoming shows that we're planning and get extra links and more material. So again, we're on Facebook. Go ahead there, become a fan of our page. Our executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.